This is KHOI 89.1 FM, Story City Ames and surrounding community.
Good morning. This is KHOI's new talk show, and we don't even really officially have a name for it, but we're going to call it Local Talk for now. I'm Ursula Rudenberg.
And I'm Don Wirth.
We are very pleased to be doing our inaugural broadcast of a show which will feature the local voices and issues and happenings in our community.
And we hope that as you listen to it and you hear what we're talking about, that as you get ideas, that you will contact us with those ideas at khoifm.org. Give us some feedback on it and suggestions for where we go from here. KHOI is a new endeavor that's been on the air for about 2.5 weeks. We just finished our testing phase, fully licensed and ready to go. And so it's a new community radio station. Tell us what community radio really is, Ursula.
Community radio is a little different from the kind of radio that many are accustomed to. So we really would like to invite you, the listener, to be part of KHOI, whether you decide you want to become involved with the operations of the station or propose a program, or whether you would just like to come in and give us feedback on what you'd like to hear. We're going to have a very local focus. We're really here to represent our community and what's happening in the Story County and surrounding areas. We will have some nationally syndicated program. Our main focus is to be the voice of this community.
And as Ursula said, this community is Story County and the surrounding counties that Hardin, Marshall, Hamilton, Boone, and into Polk. These are our focus, and the community, the people, the activities that occur in this area are where we want to bring our focus. And we want to hear stories, and we want to follow up on stories. So contact us with your ideas and how you can help us find those interesting stories to share with your neighbors.
As you listen to the station, you'll hear that at the top of the hour, the identification is Story City Ames. The reason why we identify ourselves that way is because Story City is technically our city of license. Our broadcast towers are in the vicinity of Story City, and our broadcast studios are going to be built in downtown Ames at the old Ames Pantorium building on Douglas Avenue. We are so pleased that we are beginning our station in the very spot that Ames began as a town.
That's right. The original plat of Ames ran from Duff Avenue to Burnett, and then from the railroad tracks up to 7th Street. And so we're practically right in the direct center of that, of where that all occurred. And to start off our broadcast, we were fortunate to contact Kathy Speck and the Ames Historical Society about an exhibit that they have, and Ursula conducted an interview with Kathy, and that's what we're going to have. A little more about that, Ursula?
The exhibit at the Octagon really demonstrates that Ames was originated because of the railroad. So this exhibit is very, very interesting. It's about really the essence of how our town started. And Kathy Speck came over to our building the other day and told us a little bit about the exhibit. This is Ursula Rudenberg with KHOI, and I'm here with Kathy Speck, who is the president of the Historical Society.
Co-president.
Co-president.
Okay.
Who's the other president?
Mary Atherley, sharing the team. We're a great team effort.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming over and telling us about the railroad exhibit.
Well, the title of the show is Rail Reality, How the Trains Made Ames, and it will be up through the 28th of October. So all of our community residents will have a few more months to take advantage of the train exhibit.
And where is it?
It is at the Octagon, 427 Douglas. The historical exhibit is on third floor. There are two galleries on the third floor, and the main gallery has the more historical slant, we looked at six very critical time periods when the trains were very key in what was going on in Ames, and we took an in-depth look at that. And the display panels are full of wonderful pictures and wonderful stories. It does take a little time to get through it, so we hope that if you run out of time that you will come back. The other gallery on third floor has model trains. Woohoo! And one of them is a model of what the rail yard used to look like when it was directly behind Main Street. So we had good information about what the rail yard looked like about the mid-1930s. So it is a reconstruction of all the busy buzz of activity that used to go on right behind our Main Street with the railroad. In addition to that, there's a model of the Dinky, which was the little railroad that ran back and forth between downtown Ames and the campus from 1891 to 1907. And that model is animated, so it like the Dinky used to, goes back and forth. But in addition to the models, we have a superb exhibit of posters in railroad art starting in 1869 through 1955. And it's a wonderful overview of how the railroad was enticing passengers to travel by train.
It's a very beautiful exhibit of those posters. The one I loved the most was one that says up in the sky.
Up in the air.
Up in the air.
Yes, the train will take you up in the air, and there's a picture of the Rocky Mountains. Yeah. I think it's the prettiest poster in the whole show, but you know, you'll have to go and look yourself and make your own decision.
So who put this exhibit together?
Well, we had three very ambitious curators doing the research, finding the pictures, and working with our graphic artist. It was me and Peggy Baer, who is retired from the Department of Transportation, where she was head of the rail division. So this was a natural assignment for her. And our third cohort was Bob Bourne, retired from the SciRide. But he also is a true rail fan. And so the three of us made a great team in putting this together. It took us over a year. We installed the last 2 weeks in May and promptly took a week-long nap when that was finished. But it was a great project, and we hope that people will learn things that they really never knew before.
What made this happen?
What was the inspiration? Well, a very significant event. It's the sesquicentennial, the 150th anniversary of the founding of the Union Pacific Railroad. And, of course, Ames was established by the railroad. So Ames is a Union Pacific town, and it seemed like the right thing to commemorate that great event and to look in depth at how the trains made Ames.
How did the trains make Ames?
It was the mid-1860s. The Railroad Act, signed by Abraham Lincoln, had designated Omaha as the starting point for the construction of the Union Pacific Railroad west to the coast. So in order for the new Union Pacific Railroad to connect with the existing railroads to the east, rail lines had to be built across the state of Iowa. So Iowa was very critical in getting rail freight and rail traffic from Chicago to the new terminus in Omaha. So there were three railroad companies in competition to build across Iowa. And one of those three railroads was the Cedar Rapids and Missouri River Railroad. And they picked up a bankrupt railroad that had gotten to Cedar Rapids. So a new company formed, and they had a very dynamic man in charge, John Blair, and he raised the money, and he was in the field building, and he beat out the other two railroads getting to Omaha first. So Ames was on the route that John Blair established across Iowa. This was in the days of steam, so every 20 or 30 miles they needed a water stop. So he was building the railroad and establishing towns all across the state of Iowa to service the new railroad after it was up and running. So Ames was one of those stops. Blair was aware of the state of Iowa's plan to build the college. He thought it would be an appropriate place to put one of those new towns. He was a part of the Ames family producing shovels for the gold rush. He, too, believed in the grand future for the railroad. That was a vision that he shared with Abraham Lincoln. And the railroad developers were hard-pressed to raise money. They were scrounging everywhere for friends who would loan them money for this huge enterprise. And Ames and his brother were two of the very visionary people who they really saw the promise of the railroad. So they loaned Blair money so that he could continue to build his railroad across the state of Iowa. So Blair was rewarding some of those good friends by naming towns after them. Now, Mr. Ames never did make it to Ames, but when the Congregational Church built the very first church in Ames, still on the location where it is today at 6th and Kellogg, he sent a beautiful cast bell for the belfry. And the Ames bell is still in the belfry at the Congregational Church. And a fine bell it is.
So Ames existed as a town before the railroad came. Presumably it had another name or it didn't have a name
well,
yet?
The town was platted in December 1864, and so it was established just prior to the time that the track came through. And the track came through in about January the next year, 1865. They built the first little depot in April 1865. So it was just a tiny bit before the track actually came through, but very close.
So it never had a different name.
No.
It was Ames.
No, it was always Ames from the very beginning. In all of the states west of the Mississippi, wherever the railroad went, the towns followed, settlement followed. So it was easy in the late 1860s to get from the East Coast to Iowa, to central Iowa, all along the route between Davenport and Omaha. It was very easy to get into central Iowa by way of the train. So the train spurred development all along the line. And with these railroads, it was so costly. And I mentioned how Blair picked up a railroad that had been bankrupt. That happened all over all the time. And so one would go bankrupt, and it would be picked up by a new company, and they would change the route. And towns would absolutely die if the railroad missed them by a mile or even 2 miles. So it was critical in those early days when there were no good roads and travel by wagon or horseback was extremely difficult. The railroad was absolutely pivotal.
The area that is now the parking lot behind Main Street.
Yes.
I remember that used to be a switchyard
right.
when I was growing up.
Well, in any place where you have rail traffic, you have to have an awful lot of track that's devoted simply to storage of cars. And in addition to that, there were many industries and businesses that were located right along the rail yard because it was an easy matter to lay a track directly to your loading dock, for example.
Mm-hmm.
The Ames Canning Company, for example, was east at the east end of the rail yard. And they had their own siding where a freight train could back right into their loading dock, unload all of their canned goods, and then leave and join a bigger freight train to ship their goods.
And what were they canning?
They were canning mostly corn.
Of course.
Of course. A few tomatoes, some peas. They had a half a dozen things that they canned, and it was all locally grown and shipped right from here. And for a long time, passenger trains and freight trains were in great competition, and it was very tricky to schedule freight and passengers on the same two-track main line because passenger trains were notoriously off schedule, and humans are a little more difficult to manage than crates of canned mm-hmm. corn. So it was really a challenge for the railroads to do all that scheduling. But all of that activity happened behind Main Street on the rail yards, and it was a very, very busy place, especially before a lot of those processes became automated. Ames was a crossroads in terms of rail. There were several active north-south lines as well, so Ames was very, very well connected by rail. So passengers could pick up the Fort Dodge line, go north or south down to Des Moines, or they could get on the main line, the east-west, and go into Chicago or to Omaha and beyond. Passenger traffic probably hit its peak during the World War II years, continued very active into the 50s, but by 1960, the very last passenger train left the depot in Ames, and passenger service was over that era.
Thank you.
Don, let's talk for a few minutes more about the beginning of Ames. Tell me a little bit about Cynthia Duff.
Cynthia Duff and her husband were residents of the area. We can't say the residents of Ames because they were here before Ames was. They owned about a 320-acre farm up where the Meeker School is now, up around 20th and Duff in that area of town. The residents of what was the original plot of Ames weren't real hot on the railroads coming through their part of the state and were objecting to it. So John Blair, who was the president and creator of the railroad station, the Cedar Rapids and Missouri River Railroad that was the original railroad came through town, contacted Cynthia, and she acted as his agent, buying the land from the original landowners and then turning around and selling it to Blair and the railroad company. That was, as you can imagine, was met with mixed reactions. Some people were happy, some people weren't so happy. But the railroad came through, and as such, the town sprang up around here, as we said in earlier, the original plat between Duff and Burnett and the railroad tracks and 7th Street. And we at the Pantorium are about a block from Duff Avenue, about a block from the railroad tracks and where the original train station was, and about half a block from where Cynthia Duff ran a restaurant. The location of that is now the Cynthia O. Duff Plaza, the walkway between Main Street and the parking lot south of Main Street. Cynthia was important to the creation of Ames, and we hope that our location here is symptomatic that we're going to be important to the development and spreading and sharing of the community of Ames and Story County in the area.
I spoke a little bit longer with Kathy, and she talked about some of the features that are of interest, so let's go back and hear the rest of what Kathy had to say about that exhibit.
So we have to talk about the dinky just a little bit.
All right, sure. Well, in 1890, there were about three ways to get out to campus. Number one, you walked on the railroad main line, hoping that there weren't any trains coming through. And then when you got across Squaw Creek, you'd jump off on a little path that paralleled the track, and then you would walk to campus. Now, there was what they called the campus bus, which was actually a horse-drawn cart. It would pick you up down here at the corner of Main and Duff and take you out by road a couple of times a day. And then there was another walking route. But very unreliable. Half of the year, it was too muddy or wet to traverse very easily. And so by 1890, it was a very high priority to get better transportation between downtown Ames and the campus. And there were a group of about a dozen investors who put their money toward a small-scale railroad. They called it the Ames and College Railway. They had an agreement with the city of Ames to maintain a line and a regular schedule between downtown and campus, and they launched on the 4th of July, 1891, and provided regular service. They went from about 7 in the morning till about 10 o'clock at night, about every 20 minutes throughout the day, out and back. It was a little coal-powered steam train, and often spit a lot of cinders on the passengers as they were traveling along. They had three passenger cars that were often overstuffed, and people had to kind of hang on to the sides during the busiest parts of the day. And it had one flat car that was used to haul freight, and a number of the building projects in the 1890s, like the Campanile and Beecher Hall. Mm-hmm. So it was a very hard-working little train. And by 1907, the Fort Dodge Line, which was going north-south through Ames, saw an opportunity to purchase the Ames and College Railway and hook it into their north-south line. They converted from the little steam train to an electric trolley. And so after 1907, the dinky was converted to an electric trolley, and it not only ran from downtown Ames to the campus, but you could continue down past Boone to the main north-south line, and you could be in Des Moines by the afternoon. And I think at its peak, they were running probably 14 back-and-forth trips between Ames and Des Moines, and it's hard to believe that in 1907 we had better public transportation to Des Moines than we have today. But it was very efficient and very popular.
And where did the word dinky come from?
Well, you know, we speculate.
Nobody knows.
Nobody really knows. Obviously, it might be a reference to the small size. It was a standard gauge meaning that regular trains could run on the Dinky's tracks. But it was just a very small-scale train. And the little locomotive was the sort of locomotive that you would find in the rail yards, just a little small-scale train just used for moving cars, not for hauling full-scale trains over long distances, just a little train for moving one or two cars here and there. And in a working rail community, that's called a donkey engine. So we wonder if it's just sort of a slurring of the word donkey. Mm-hmm. Dinky, donkey, little, you know, I don't know. Those are our speculations as to where the name came from. And I think it was the Iowa State students that conferred that name.
There was one more thing that jumped out at me at the exhibit that I wanted to talk about for
sure.
A minute. The line of sycamore trees.
Yes.
That goes between downtown and campus town.
Yes.
Now, I remember when I was young, there was 6th Street was a different street, which went right under those trees. I think it's the old road now that goes to the power plant. So every time you would drive, and so every time we would drive down 6th Street, we would drive under this line of trees that we call the money trees, because they would sparkle silver in the light, and they were so beautiful.
The sycamores, they were planted after the Dinky stopped running. So they were planted, I think, the Dinky stopped running in 1907 and then converted to the electric Fort Dodge line. And the Fort Dodge people kind of routed the trolley a little bit around the north side of campus. The Dinky used to go right down the middle of campus. It used to go in front of what is now Cat Hall, and then it would arrive at its little station, which is the hub, which is between Beardshire and the library now. But so when it was converted to the electric trolley, the tracks were switched to the north side of campus, so it kind of went around. So in addition to the trolley tracks, there was also a main line spur that mostly delivered coal to the power plant on campus. So there were tracks right along, it's kind of where the Cyride bus garage is today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then running parallel to that spur was a cinder path. It was a walking path. And for many, many years, it was just covered with cinders, you know, from the coal. In about 1910 or 1911, Iowa State's horticulturalist thought it would be really great to plant this row of sycamores. And so it started at the old landscape architecture building on campus, mm-hmm. which is still called that. It's on the east side of campus near the journalism building. So there were 50 sycamores that were planted running parallel to the cinder path and the former route of the Dinky, and then for a while, the spur from the Chicago and Northwestern. So it went all the way from the old landscape architecture building to Squaw Creek, 50 beautiful sycamore trees. And we have a great picture of those sycamores when they were just planted in just 4-foot-high sticks. And all of these years later now, mm-hmm. the 42 of the original 50 sycamores are still alive and thriving. And there are certain angles when you're walking where you can definitely see that beautiful row of sycamores. It's just a wonderful historic reference landscape here in Ames. And it was actually listed in a noteworthy landscape listing, a national listing.
It's one of the beautiful things about our town.
It is so special. And the shade that those big, big leaves creates on hot days like today, mm-hmm. it's really special. I was just astonished at every turn to learn new things about our town. To learn, first of all, about the early days, the race across Iowa, and how John Blair won the race and put Ames on the map and on the first transcontinental route. Like, it was, you just can't imagine how huge that was for our town. And then just the busy passenger service. There was one statistic I read that at one time in the late 30s, Ames sold more passenger tickets than any town in Iowa.
Uh-huh.
Because of its location on both the north-south and east-west rail lines.
It's like a crossroads.
Like a crossroads.
Did anything really surprise you?
Well, everything surprised me because I was so new to the subject matter. Mm-hmm. But Ames, for example, had a woman station master in the 1920s, probably the only one in the whole country. She was very pivotal. The development, the simultaneous development of the telegraph, because the railroad companies knew they had to be able to communicate easily from station to station. And so simultaneously with the laying of the track was the installation of telegraph poles. so that there was this communication system that had to be in existence absolutely at the same time. And that was something I really, I didn't even think about, but it was new to me and very interesting to learn.
Did it change the way you look at the town now?
It really does. It really does. All those trains that roar through, you really look at them in a completely different way, and you see how incredibly important they were and continue to be.
In today's town, how do you see the railroad? I mean, obviously, we're always crossing railroad tracks in this town.
That's right.
And we're seeing trains go through all the time, very often, really.
Yeah.
How do you think, beyond that, beyond the sounds that you hear, how do you think that it affected how we live today?
Well, you know, it's a little harder today because in the earlier days, railroad, the people who worked on the railroad lived right here in town. And that's not so true anymore. And, of course, we were talking about the railroads behind Main Street with all the spurs that went right to the front door of our or the back door of our local businesses. And that doesn't happen so much. Although, one of the reasons that Barilla Pasta established their factory in Ames was because they could get their own rail spur. And some of the other big industries like Ball Plastics, those folks are in our town because of the easy rail access. So it still has an impact on the industry and of our industry of our town. But certainly the railroad is extremely pivotal to Iowa. You know, in the fall, we see the harvest of our fields going to market. We see coal coming to central Iowa from Wyoming, which is still a very essential source of energy. And so we may not live next door to someone who works on the railroad, but our daily lives are absolutely impacted by what the railroad delivers.
You know, what's funny, I lived in Brooklyn for the last 30 years in New York City. And at night, I would hear these loud horns. And I would always think to myself, the train's going through. That's the train. And I think I was living there for maybe 15, 20 years before one night, I finally, it dawned on me that those were boats. It's the way they say you can take the girl out of Iowa,
that's
but you
right.
can't take
you
Iowa,
can't
out,
take
of the girl.
Iowa out of the girl. You just assumed.
Because
horns,
the sound
yeah.
of those trains is what you grow up with in this town.
Absolutely.
It's part of our environment.
It is. Yeah. Well, I was tickled. My little nephew was visiting from the San Francisco area just a couple of weeks ago, and they were down on Main Street. He and his family were down on Main Street, and one of the Union Pacific roared through, the locomotives roared through with the beautiful big flag on the side of it, and he stopped in his tracks, and he says, "Hey, that's the train that goes through my town." And we said, "You are absolutely right," and that's how far it goes.
That's the connection.
From Ames all the way to San Francisco. He figured that out. So, can I talk a little bit about our gallery talks? Do we have?
Absolutely.
During the run of the exhibit, which, as I said, is through October 28th, each month we are having a special gallery talk on a train-related subject. So our August, September, and October gallery talks are still coming up. Third Tuesday of each month, 7 p.m. in the gallery at the Octagon, surrounded by our beautiful exhibit.
And the gallery is where?
Third floor. Octagon, 427 Douglas, Ames, Iowa.
That's 427 Douglas.
Douglas, yes. Tuesday, October 21st, 7 p.m., Mail on Rails. We're going to hear the history of the railroad post office. Very, very unique chapter in American history. Tuesday, September 18th, 7 p.m., one of the Union Pacific representatives is going to come and talk about the railroad today. I mean, we are all stopped by those trains. What in the heck is on those trains? Brenda Mainwaring is going to come and talk about what's going on with Union Pacific today. And I think her talk will be very enlightening, and we'll have a chance to ask her a lot of the questions. The final gallery talk in October is actually going to be on a Saturday at 2 o'clock, and we hope that's a good time for families and kids to come. The ISU Railroad Club is going to come and talk about today's freight train. And it's my understanding that those freight cars have a little code on the side. And if you know how to translate the code, you'll know what's in the car. So they're going to talk about what's in the cars, and they're going to talk about other things going on with trains. So 2 o'clock, Saturday, October 6th. And those are our three remaining gallery talks, and we hope folks will put those on their calendar and come.
Excellent. And if somebody listening to this would like to find out more, or would like to look up the dates later, where can they find the information?
They are on our Ames Historical Society website, www.ameshistoricalsociety.org.
That's ameshistoricalsociety.org.
And there is a link right from our homepage with more information about the gallery talks and about the exhibit. And while you're online, you can explore hundreds of local stories online. We consider our website our virtual museum, and you can do a lot of research and just a lot of recreational browsing right on our website. And if you have not taken a look, we hope that you will.
Tell us just a little bit about the Historical Society.
Well, we have been in existence since 1980, founded by Farwell Brown, and some of our residents will remember him as our Ames historian. He has written many books on different subjects and has since passed away. So we are a relatively young historical organization, just 31 or 2 years here in the business, but we are hard at work developing a history center for the community of Ames, and we are very dependent on memberships to float our day-to-day operations. We are located at 416 Douglas, right across the street from the Octagon. We have regular open hours Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday afternoon, and we do have a historical collection and a wonderful archives that people can come down and use to do research.
So, again, if somebody wants to find out about the Historical Society, it's
ameshistoricalsociety.org. We're also in the phone book, easy to find, Ames Historical Society, 232-2148.
232-2148. And how do you feel about Ames?
How do I feel about Ames? What a great place to live. And once you know the stories, it explains a lot of things. A lot of the way, of course, we are the way we are because of where we've been. Mm-hmm. And once you understand those stories, you can stop scratching your head so much about how the trains made Ames.
This is really about the heart and soul of our town's origins.
It is.
So it gives you a great feeling of connection to really what this town is. And there's really something for everybody. There's paintings, there's posters, there's models, there's a lot of kind of detailed paper documents for people who like the details.
And some artifacts.
So it's a great exhibit. It's just a lot of fun. And thank you so much for coming and telling us about it.
And don't forget, it'll be there through October 28th.
Absolutely.
And thank you for having me on the radio.
Back from Fremont on this old freight train. Across the Iowa border, rolling over these great plains. 20 years a conductor, an old locomotive riding home again. Steaming toward tomorrow with dreams from yesterday. Steaming toward tomorrow. You better get on board, all aboard, for this train pulls away. Miss Kate Shelley High Bridge, we'll be crossing you real soon. Over the Des Moines River, then 3 more miles into Boone. Spend the night with my wife. Come morning, I'll be called out by noon. Steaming toward tomorrow with dreams from yesterday. Steaming toward tomorrow. You better get on board, haul aboard, for this train pulls away. Next month is my vacation, September and old puffer belly days. Gonna join that celebration with people from nearly every state. Take a ride on 1385 and feel them old-fashioned railroad ways. steam and talk tomorrow with dreams from yesterday. Steam and talk tomorrow. You'd better get on board, haul aboard, for this train pulls away. You better get on board, haul aboard, for this train pulls away.
Thank Kathy Sveck for that information about the exhibit at the Octagon. And just a reminder that more information about the Historical Society can be found at AmesHistoricalSociety.org. That's AmesHistoricalSociety.org. And also for a really great wealth of photographs from the history of Ames can be found at the Ames Public Library Archive online, which is AmesPublicLibrary.org. Go to the link that signifies the Farwell Brown photo collection. And I'd like to just review a little bit what we're doing here with KHOI as we start to develop some form of local interview show. And if you've been listening to the station, you're hearing that we're still mostly music at this point. The reason why the station is mostly music right now is because in lieu of having produced program prepared, we're essentially using an automation system that is choosing from music that various people at the station have selected to fill the time as we develop programming. Don, you want to say a little bit about what we're planning?
Yeah, and so what we've been able to provide is between the music and this show is just a sample of where we hope to go with our programming as we move into the future and we're able to implement and develop more programs. You'll hear more news and information programs, as we said, focused on the local area, the Story County and surrounding counties. You'll hear some nationally syndicated talk show programs. But you'll also start to hear some locally produced music programs in the jazz and rhythm and blues and local artists. Those we'll be introducing into the schedule periodically as we get our hosts ready and we get the music ready. So as we move forward, we hope you'll find a nice blend of the news, information, and music that is representative of our local community. And once again, we ask that as you hear things and as you listen to the radio station, that you're able to give us feedback on it and maybe offer suggestions about topics, about music, and how we can incorporate that into our programming, because this is community radio, and community radio involves you, the listener, very much in the creation of the programming and the feedback of it, and the most importantly, in the listening to the radio station. So we hope you like what you hear here and have some ideas about how we can improve upon it and expand upon it, and will contact us as we continue to develop our program. Another element of the programming that will be a regular feature will be Ellen Taylor.
We are very pleased to bring a much-loved name to KHOI, Mr. Elwin Taylor. And Don, do you want to introduce Mr. Taylor?
Elwin, for those who have been around, have listened to public radio in Iowa and have heard him quite frequently there, as well as many commercial radio stations and speaking engagements throughout the state. So we're quite honored, quite pleased that Elwin has agreed to work with us and give us daily weather outlooks. But just for those who might not know you, Elwin, or kind of give us a little bit of a background about how long you've been in Iowa, what your role is at Iowa State, and why you do all these speaking engagements around the state. And I'll turn it over to you, so just give us a little background.
Oh, thank you, Don. I wasn't born in Iowa, and I wasn't raised in Iowa, but I got here just as quickly as I could. I was raised in the western United States, in the state of Utah. I went to school in Missouri at Washington University in St. Louis. Of course, immediately fell in love with the Midwest. After doing a few years in the Army as an Army meteorologist, which was a very good experience because it brought me up to state-of-the-art on satellite meteorology, which was the coming thing as we came into the 70s. Then I taught at Auburn University in Alabama for a little over 9 years. My mother told me about an opening for a climatologist at Iowa State University. My mother was a professor at Utah State University at the time, and she saw the job announcements, and she said, "I think you might like that." And so she gave me the phone number, and I called and talked to the head of the agronomy department, happened to be John Pesek. Mm-hmm. And we had a delightful hour on the phone. And come January, I was here, January of 1979. And it has just been a delightful place to be. I kept working in the thing that I loved the most, the effect of weather on living things, whether the living things be plants or people or animals in general. And so I accepted the position of extension climatologist at Iowa State University. Extension climatologist, the person that is responsible for making the people of the state of Iowa the best informed population in the world when it comes to climate. That's been my goal. That's really been the only project I've worked on since I have been in the state of Iowa. January 1979. Snow drifts that were higher than the cars along the sides of the road. That was a harsh winter, and it was cold. In fact, it was the second most harsh winter, as near as I can tell from the histories of climate in this area, during the century, at least here in Ames. And so my wife said, "What are we doing moving from Alabama, children that didn't even own coats?" The day that my children arrived, it was below zero. They were in short pants coming directly from Alabama. It was, we knew better, but we couldn't do any better at the time. Said, "Why are we here?" Economy, I said, huh? "It only takes just one glance at the hallway of the agronomy building at Iowa State University. You're looking at the Hall of Fame when it comes to scientists that work with agriculture." Well, as soon as my wife realized that, she said, "Well, of course we've got to be here." And here we are, and have loved every hour that we have been in Iowa since early in 1979. And of course, weather is not just my hobby, which it's been my vocation since I was a sophomore in high school. And so the thing that I love most as a vocation, as a hobby, as just something to be interested in, ended up something that I could maybe help other people with a bit, understanding the climate, how it works. And this is the thing I love the most. I hope that in some ways it'll be of help to those of you that are able to listen to this radio station.
You're a climatologist. We hear a lot about meteorologists, and you also talked about agronomists. Could you just kind of enlighten us as to what the difference between those three professions are? What differentiates a climatologist from the meteorologist and the agronomist?
Well, first, the agronomist. Agronomy. The production of crops for use by people or food for animals. So the agronomy department, the department on the campus that works most directly with our making sure that our production of corn goes well in the state, that we have the right corn, the plant breeding, the plant physiology. Plant protection is another department, but closely associated to protect our plants from insects, diseases, and weed pressures. But all of these things are the agronomic sciences. Well, the greatest uncontrollable factor that controls what agronomy will be, that is, the food supply of not just Iowa, but of the world, the uncontrollable factor and the major factor is the weather. So naturally, a person that's interested in climate, interested in living things, this is what we work on, the effect of weather on what the plants will be doing, what the animals will be doing, how the weather influences them. That's the connection of weather, of climate, to plants and animals. and agronomy is where I am housed. It could have been in animal science. It could have been in earth science, for that matter. But still, the interest would be the effect on living things. Mm-hmm. Next, difference between climatology and meteorology. Climatology became rather narrow in the public view and even in the scientific view for a few years. But historically, and we're talking clear back to the time of the Greeks, the climate was derived from the word inclination, the slope of the hill. People noticed that the east slope and the west slope of the hills had a different kind of trees. Maybe the west slope had no trees because of the hot afternoon sun. The sun is just as hot in the morning, inclination of the land. Well, the science of climatology then developed as to how the earth's surface and the atmosphere and the sun interact to bring our environment. Climatology. So climatology is the study of the interaction of the earth, the solid part of the earth, with the atmosphere and with the sun. Meteorology would be a subscience dealing just with the status of the atmosphere itself. So meteorology is a subscience of climatology. People these days might argue with that and tell you that, no. When you just add up in everything and average it in meteorology, we'll call that climatology. Well, remember, everything that has to do with the weather and its interaction with the earth is climatology. So that was my field of choice, the broad umbrella of the environment of the earth.
Also, when I've heard you speak and I've heard your outlooks on the radio, you seem to take more of a historical, long-term view of talking about what's happening in the weather and what might be predictive based on what happened 7 years ago, 10 years ago, 100 years ago over the weather cycles. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that as to how that long-term view impacts what you do and what people will be hearing on KHOI and in your weather outlooks?
I'm almost convinced nothing new happens in the weather. It's something that's happened before. If we understand what's gone on before, we're going to understand what is going on now. Of course, in this world of a changing climate, exacerbated by human activity, there is some consideration that we may move into an environment that we have never experienced before. And I'm not talking about the type of environment as when we had nuclear bombs and that sort of thing at the end of the Second War, which was a new environment for the world as well, but a new environment that is of a more subtle type, the human activity in changing the composition of the atmosphere. That the first one that we directly connected with humans was the ozone hole, as it was called, the effect of Freon on the chemistry of the atmosphere and as it interacted with other things. I was lucky to be on sort of the ground floor of that research as this was discovered. I wasn't the person that discovered it, but I was a project leader that had control of some of the money. And so I was closely connected with that during my time as a meteorologist with the U.S. Army. We've seen the increase in the carbon dioxide become significant. We're a third of the way to doubling the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and mostly because we burn fossils as fuel, and we're burning fossils faster than the Earth creates new ones. As long as we do that, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere will increase. There's no way around it. So this became my interest from a historical standpoint of what's happened and what's changing compared to the way things used to be.
Elwin's going to be creating about a 4-minute weather outlook module for us that will be airing, I guess, all week long. And so when will people be able to hear that?
Elwin's outlooks will be available on KHOI at 7:55 a.m. and 7:55 p.m. and at 12:55 at noon. So that's 5 minutes till 1 o'clock.
And I think we're about ready to wrap up and get Elwin's first outlook as we begin our initial broadcast here.
Absolutely. And thank you, Elwin, and welcome to the KHOI team.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be associated with all of you and with everyone that's listening. We'll soon be fast friends, I trust.
The sky's heavy with the coming snow, it's hanging over like a gray ghost. The ice is taking quite a hold, and the mighty muddy is a damn near froze. guess it's cold, and every year is the same old. I tell myself that I should go, but something keeps this place my home.
Next week, in fact, for the next month, is now available. This happens at about the middle of each month. The National Weather Service puts out what they call the 30-day outlook. And this happens on Thursday, the Thursday closest to the middle of each month. Then we get an outlook for 30 days, 90 days, in fact, for the coming year. Well, the closer ones are usually the more accurate. We usually start our outlooks by paying attention to what we expect during the next 14 days. This comes out 5 days a week by humans and 2 days a week by computer. We find that the one by the human beings is a little bit more accurate than the one that is done purely by computer. Nevertheless, we do have the 6 to 10 and the 8 to 14 day outlook. Currently, the precipitation outlook to go through the 30th of August is for conditions to be on the wet side of usual in North Dakota. No surprise there. On the dry side of usual in Oklahoma. No surprise there. And Iowa to be near normal, taking us through the end of the month. Above normal precipitation as well in New Mexico and Arizona. This is a bit different than what people have been thinking for the past year for New Mexico and Arizona, where they had been in a disastrous drought because of a very strong, the second strongest in history, La Nina. But as we've moved out of the La Nina and toward El Nino conditions, we expect that area to be on the wet side of usual and to continue on the wet side of usual in a general manner all the way through winter and to go dry in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and into much of Montana. The temperature during this same period is also a consideration, and we do anticipate that they will continue to be warmer than usual west of the Rocky Mountains through the 30th of the month, and cooler than usual east of the Continental Divide, which will include Iowa and Illinois, then becoming normal as it goes toward the Ohio Valley and the Appalachian Mountains. Well, cooler than usual for the rest of August is certainly a pleasant outlook. Will it go on longer than that? That is a question. Because the temperature is dividing right on the Continental Divide, and once that has persisted with being one temperature extreme on one side and the opposite extreme on the other side of the Continental Divide, continuous for more than a week, it tends to persist for months. And this often causes some very dramatic changes between the far west and the eastern portion of the U.S., meaning the eastern, east of Denver. And the reason that we sometimes have wheat be a great year when corn is low, corn be a great yield year when wheat is low, because of this temperature difference. Well, it's favoring us right now. I wouldn't be surprised if we go into a cool fall beyond the end of August and still staying warmer in the western states of Idaho, Nevada, Utah, and Arizona, that is, on the west side of the Continental Divide. That disagrees with the 30-day outlook for the month of September from the National Weather Service that expects us to go back to being warmer than usual as we were in most of June and July. Well, we shall see. I'm going to kind of lean toward climate doing what it often does until we know better.
This has been Local Talk, an hour-long program of KHOI Community Radio. Today's show was hosted by Don Wirth and myself, Ursula Rudenberg. We spoke with Kathy Sveck, the co-president of Ames Historical Society, and with Elwin Taylor, climatologist, ag meteorologist, and professor at Iowa State University. To listen to their interviews again online, go to the program link at our station's website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. And while you're there, please check out the Kickstarter video for raising the funds for KHOI's live radio broadcast studios. The music you heard during this past hour includes Backtrackin', Steaming Towards Tomorrow, and Lonesome Train by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD called The Ballad of Kay Shelley. You also heard Iowa by Craig Kenning from his CD Maktub. Local Talk is currently being aired on Mondays and Wednesdays at 7 a.m., 7 p.m., and noon. We are looking forward to expanding Local Talk to every weekday as KHOI grows with your help and support. Thank you so much for listening, and see you again soon on the radio.